the streetlights come on. It's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering is tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. Up to this point, we have heard about the tragic murder of a 9-year-old girl in 1990. We learned about the victim, Jennifer Ann Lewis of Rock Island, Illinois, and about the man accused of killing her, Stanley Liggins. We talked about the evidence used to charge Stanley with the crime and about the doubts that continue to loom over the case. Today, we will focus on Stanley's first two trials. But if you haven't been following along, we recommend you start at the beginning. We've covered a lot of information. Before Stanley went to trial for Jennifer's murder, he had three other pending charges. In August of 1990, a little over a month before Jennifer was killed, Stanley had been arrested and charged with sexual abuse of another 9-year-old girl in Milan, Illinois. He was released on bond. He stood trial for that charge early the next year. The victim testified that she had spilled Kool-Aid on her leg, and Stanley offered to clean it off. He wiped off her leg, but then reached under her swimsuit and touched her inappropriately. In February of 1991, Stanley was convicted of the sexual assault in a Rock Island County court and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. As for the second charge he was facing, the next month, a Rock Island County judge ruled that the police unlawfully arrested Stanley on a drug charge 4 days before they charged him with Jennifer's murder. That charge was dismissed. And in May of 1991, Stanley pleaded guilty to a charge of aggravated battery. He was charged in January of that year when he and another inmate in the Rock Island County Jail got in a fight over two magazines, a National Geographic and a boating magazine. According to a police report, Stanley hit the inmate 6 to 12 times, fractured his cheekbone, and bit him twice on the back. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Stanley was extradited to Scott County, Iowa in March of 1992 to await the trial for Jennifer's murder. The trial began February 10, 1993. The court appointed Gary McHenrick to serve as Stanley's defense attorney, and Scott County Attorney Bill Davis prosecuted the case. Scott County Judge James Kelly presided over the court. Gary McHenrick says the court sent out a survey to prospective jurors to gauge whether the community could give Stanley a fair trial. Then the lawyers had a chance to interview potential jurors to make sure they were fair and impartial.
If you can't establish a basis to strike a person for cause, then they're in the prospective juror pool. And in a Class A felony, you have 10 peremptory strikes. And the state has 10 peremptory strikes. After all my peremptory strikes, I still had a husband and wife on the jury panel, and I still had a white guy from South Africa on the jury panel. The assault victim ended up being one of the alternates. The simple fact is that every one of my strikes, you know, based upon our questioning, was someone that we felt less comfortable with having on the jury than the people that remain.
One of these jurors was Kelvin Forder, a white man from South Africa. He was a chiropractor in the Quad Cities at the time of this trial and served on the jury with his wife. Kelvin shares his first impression of Stanley.
I've grown up with black people all my life, you know, in Africa, and most of them, you know, they can be, I won't say threatening, but they do appear sometimes to be aggressive looking, or, you know, I don't want to sound like a racist or anything like that. You know, the black people, I think, have had a really bad deal in this, as a global population. I think, you know, they've been discriminated against greatly, and You know, I had the philosophy that we were also in the same predicament as them thousands of years ago. You know, it's just civilization comes about by time and evolution and, you know, character building and stuff like that. We didn't jump out of the trees overnight and become civil like we are today, you know. So they're on that process of, I think, becoming like we are. I mean, I'm sure if you look back in time, I think we were all black originally. We all came from Africa by all appearances, you know, from anthropology. And I think the reason our skins changed color was because the white people moved north and they lived in a colder climate. And you never ever saw a black polar bear, did you? So I'm assuming that's why our skins end up white. We had to figure out a way to cook, had to figure out a way to stay warm, and our brains grew larger and we ended up with white skin. So having lots of sunlight and lots of food and, you know, in a situation where they really didn't have to think much about food gathering and survival, they stayed pretty primitive. Not that that's a bad thing.
Bonita Van Loon was another juror. She worked for John Deere at the time. She says Stanley looked confident.
During the whole trial, he looked kind of smug, like, I will never, ever get convicted for this. He had that kind of, I don't know, kind of a half... not really a smile, but that kind of looked like nobody's ever going to convict me.
And Bonita says she didn't see any signs of prejudice on the jury.
That really never even occurred to me that that would be part of the decision or the issue or anything like that. No, I did not pick up on that at all.
All the jurors were white. Judge Stephen Quarry is the chief judge for the 10th Judicial Circuit in Peoria, Illinois. He has not studied Stanley Liggins' case and will not comment on a specific trial. But he works to improve jury representation.
We tend to look at this on the basis of race, but there is a concern, at least on my part, that a jury of 12 should not be made up solely of middle to upper class people, irregardless of what race they are, or even what gender there are. But if there are flaws in the system structurally that leave out the lower class disproportionately, that's something that we ought to look at correcting. And frankly, in some of our communities, when it falls disproportionately on the lower economic scale, it falls disproportionately on minorities.
There's a study called The Impact of Jury Race in Criminal Trials. It was published in 2012 in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, and it analyzed how conviction rates changed depending on the racial makeup of a jury. Researchers looked at 700 felony trials in Florida and divided them into four groups. First, if there was a white defendant in an all-white jury, the conviction rate was just below 70%. When there was a white defendant in a mixed jury, meaning at least one African-American, the conviction rate was about 70%. So for a white defendant, the jury composition didn't have much of an impact on the conviction rate. Now, when there was a black defendant in a mixed jury, the conviction rate was still about the same, about 70%. The only difference in the four groups was when a black defendant had an all-white jury. In that situation, the conviction rate jumped to about 80%.
There was only one of the quadrants that was higher than the others three, and that was the category of an African-American defendant in an all-white jury. So that's concerning. That's concerning.
Gary McHenrick says race can be an issue in the courtroom.
One of the things that I think you're always confronted with as a criminal defense attorney, you know, back then and still today, to a large extent, is how do you deal with implicit bias, you know, particularly on racial grounds.
Bill Davis says he didn't see a problem with the jury's makeup.
It was luck of the draw. We didn't systematically exclude black people or people of color from the jury. And you're not entitled to a jury makeup that looks like you. You're entitled to a draw from the general population where people aren't excluded.
And he says the jury based their decision on the evidence.
Objectivity, pure objectivity, is something that we strive for. So if you put 12 people in a jury box, you're going to have all walks of life. And those people generally will read the rules, the instructions from the court, And they, if somebody's got a terrible bias they bring in there, the other people are supposed to, and generally I think they do, balance that off so that that person won't let his bias convict or acquit a person.
Juror Kelvin Forder says the prosecution's evidence was convincing, like the witness who says she saw taillights near the crime scene that night that resembled Stanley's car. It has since come out that this witness was a paid police informant for one of the detectives in the Davenport Police Department. She started working as an informant the year before the trial. But Kelvin says knowing that wouldn't have changed his mind about her testimony.
Well, she was a black woman, so I would, you know, I would think that she would not turn against her own race. They seem to be pretty closely tied in with each other when it comes to backing up each other. Let's put it that way. You usually find a black woman votes for a black man or vice versa, and they don't care whether they're right or wrong. They back them up. Now, let's put it the other way. If she was testifying against a white guy, then possibly, and there's some conflict there, then, you know, if she didn't like white people, there might be that type of thing happening.
Bonita Van Loon remembers this testimony also. She says the witness seemed credible, even now, after learning of her status as an informant.
I think she lived across the field and that she was looking out her window and that she saw the pattern of the tail lights, which were unique. They had a real distinctive tail light formation, and I believe one of the lights was out. And when they turned on the lights in the courtroom, that was really quite a dramatic thing to see.
Bill Davis says it was important to the detectives to show the car to the jury. So Bill got it admitted into evidence, and they brought it into the courtroom.
I had a guy working at the city garage who had literally built Indy 500 cars. And he's the one who engineered it, and the cops on their own. I don't think they got overtime. I know they get overtime. I don't think they got paid to do most of it. Took the car apart, made a shell out of it, cut it off in right behind the front seat so it looked like something from the Flintstones. And they took all the heavy stuff out and then built a frame for it with big caster wheels that you couldn't see. And the back wheels put back on. And then took the taillights and wired it to a motorcycle battery with a switch in the back so they could be operated from just lifting the trunk. And it was like a tinker toy. You could take it apart and bring it up on the elevator. And they did. And they had it together. So then it was like, oh, my God, we did all of this. And now my obligation is to convince the judge that it's appropriate to bring in into evidence. And, of course, the defense, Gary McHenrick and Doug Scoble, were jumping up and down that it is a demonstrative exhibit and it should be out in the parking lot and they can go see it. I said, all evidence is demonstrative. This is important because that car is important to a couple of witnesses. Because it's unique. It's unique in the light pattern. It had six taillights, three on each side, two bulbs in each, and they were burned out in a certain unique pattern.
Chris Miner covered the trial for WQAD.
The car. When they unveiled the car, there were gasps. And you're not supposed to talk in court, obviously, but everybody was saying, wow.
Kelvin says this display was compelling.
They brought the whole car into the courtroom at the trial and indicated, you know, that the taillight was defective and wasn't functioning at the time, so that must have been the car that he'd seen. And, you know, I thought that was pretty compelling, but I actually drew the whole timeline down for the jury.
We read the prosecution's timeline from that night in our third episode. Bill Davis says all the evidence and witnesses led to Stanley.
He was available. And all of the facts fit as to him having done the crime. The case came together totally without, there's no red herring. There are red herrings. There's always red herrings. But there was nothing that put any doubt in my mind that we had the right guy and that he'd committed this crime.
Juror Bonita Van Loon says Bill Davis proved his case.
I think he did an excellent job. I don't think anybody could have done a better job than he did with it all.
And Chris Miner agrees.
I was not a juror. I was an independent journalist. And that's first and foremost was my job. But I can say, yeah, I believe all the circumstantial evidence added up to Stanley Liggins.
After closing arguments, the jury deliberated for 7 hours.
But the funny thing is, they had ordered us lunch, and we decided not to give them the verdict until they brought our lunch in. We were going to let the city or whoever pay for us for our lunch before we told them. Their decision actually was reached fairly quickly, though.
On February 19th, the jury convicted Stanley of first-degree murder, first-degree kidnapping, sexual abuse, and willful injury. Early the next month, Judge James Kelly sentenced Stanley to 3 life terms in prison without parole. Iowa doesn't have the death penalty, but Iowa Governor Terry Branstad was quoted in the Des Moines Register shortly after Jennifer was killed, saying he supports capital punishment in cases like this. He said, quote, in cases where an individual is guilty of a crime such as rape or kidnapping and then murders the victim, the death penalty should be available. However, capital punishment was never instated in Iowa. Stanley appealed his conviction. In 1994, the Iowa Supreme Court ordered a new trial because it said jurors could have been prejudiced by evidence about Stanley selling drugs. Bill Davis says after the appeal, the kidnapping, sex abuse, and willful injury convictions were overturned and couldn't be retried in court.
They said I didn't put in enough evidence of territorial jurisdiction that it happened in Iowa. I was able to keep the murder case because Iowa has a particular statute which says you have a presumption of the crime having occurred where the body is found. When I got the case back from the Supreme Court, I couldn't use any evidence of the drug dealing, and I didn't present the jury with the crimes of arson, kidnapping, or the rape.
The second trial was moved 70 miles north to Dubuque, Iowa, because pretrial publicity made it too difficult to find another jury in Davenport. Dubuque gained national attention in the early 1990s when crosses were burned in the city. And in 1992, the Ku Klux Klan spread a message of racial purity in the community. Despite this reputation, Stanley's new defense attorney, Mike Tobey, says the all-white jury was not a problem in this case.
Frankly, I think that my jury was ready to bend over backwards to disprove the picture of Dubuque that had been painted pre-trial with the Klan connections and other hate group activity. And it was my client who, unfortunately, change the possibility that their minds would be open or even misguidedly biased toward us.
Stanley had an outburst in front of the jury.
Stanley stood up and started what all of us have referred to and my peers refer to as motherfucking the jury. He called them all kinds of racists, profanely so. Obviously, his demeanor was extraordinarily angry. He shouted at them. Combination, adjective, adverb, noun that he used most commonly during that disruptive speech was motherfucker. I don't know how long it went on. It seemed like forever, but probably only 30 seconds. And I have to admit, I actually had reached up and tried to grab his belt to jerk him back down into his seat, but I couldn't. And I think that may well have been the turning point in our future in Dubuque.
Jimmy Reardon worked on the maintenance crew at the Dubuque airport. He served on the jury and remembers Stanley shouting at them.
I don't know the correct word, was it white trash or all white folks or whatever the heck it was. I'm not sure what it was, but He wasn't a very pleasant sort of a fella, and I know that. I mean, he almost acted like he'd really care about what's going on around him, you see.
Jennifer's mother, Sherry McCormick, testified at both trials about how she knew Stanley. Her husband, Joseph Glenn, was in jail. She was pregnant and needed money to bail Joe out before the baby was born. A friend introduced her to Stanley, and she started selling cocaine for him in Rock Island. She says she told the truth during the first trial and was upset that her connection to Stanley was withheld from the second jury.
We weren't able to mention how I knew him the second time, which I felt like, that's lying. You know, I told the truth and nothing but the truth. If the jury or the lawyers are going to say, well, how did you know Stanley? You know, the first time you told him the truth, this time you can't mention it. That's how I knew him, period. You don't want to keep anything out. So but I'm thinking a white girl, pregnant, her husband's in jail, she's got a black man in her house and she's selling his drugs. What's the jury going to think?
Loris Aimling worked for John Deere. He served on the jury in Dubuque and says that even though they weren't told about the drugs, the jurors were able to make that connection.
I figured they were not allowed to tell us that the mother of the girl was doing drugs and buying drugs from him, but it was pretty evident.
The prosecution once again displayed Stanley's car in the courtroom. Jimmy was surprised by the display.
He had her body in a, he had put her in the back of the trunk of the car, I guess. And then he just brought her over into Scott County and set her afire, you see. That really, I think that was probably the most damaging evidence that there was.
The prosecution also called Frank Rising as a witness. He's the man who shared a jail cell with Stanley and claims Stanley confessed to the murder. Mike Toby says there's no way Stanley would have made a confession to Frank.
Well, I think Rising's lying his ass off. Stanley's too smart to talk to a guy like Frank Rising. You can smell snitch. I can smell snitch around Frank Rising. There's no way in the world that Stanley Liggins would ever acknowledge criminal conduct to a Frank Rising.
Frank Rising says he is not a snitch, and he has never told on anybody else.
It was the truth. A guy like that deserves life in prison. Anybody that could do anything like that to a child, they deserve that.
Mike Toby believes juries are easily convinced by cellmate testimony.
For some reason, juries love them. They just think they're dandy. And you could tell them, well, now we've promised him not to charge him with this theft and this burglary, and we're going to try to get him for the other burglaries he did. We're going to try to get him to a kind of a nicer prison that's a little less strict and has some camps or farms and real rehabilitation programs. You could tell the jurors that. And it makes no difference to them.
Laura says he wasn't persuaded by Frank Rising's testimony.
That didn't impress me a whole lot because I knew a lot of people that tried to get favoritism or get a reduced sentence and stuff by testifying against somebody, so I kind of blew that one off.
Bill Davis says the jury in Dubuque deliberated longer than the first jury.
I didn't do as well with that jury as I thought I would. The jury was out a lot longer and scared me to death. They finally convicted, but I found it to be a little discerning.
The jury took 12 hours to decide their verdict, but Jimmy Reardon made up his mind fairly quickly.
In my mind, he was the one that did it, and I thought to myself, basically, I hope you burn in hell for it.
Loris Aimling was the last juror to be convinced of Stanley's guilt.
Probably my assertion that he didn't have time to do it. He couldn't have got there and done that and then did all this stuff. And then when the body was found, there wasn't enough time for him to be there. And we discussed that many times. Myself and another juror pretty much stuck to that. And matter of fact, they even once went to the judge and said, we've got a hung jury. And the judge says, go back and do it again. And while we were sitting there, I was reading through the stuff that they presented to us. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. He did have time to kill her, and if he had her in the car with him the whole time, it makes sense with everything. And I told the jurors that, and I said I was changing my vote to guilty. And within minutes, we had a verdict.
Once again, Stanley was found guilty of first-degree murder. And once again, the conviction was overturned. In 2013, the Iowa Court of Appeals vacated the second conviction and granted Stanley a new trial. Stanley's third trial is expected to take place in May, more than 26 years after the crime was committed. Scott County Attorney Mike Walton will prosecute the case with his sister and co-counsel Julie Walton, and Derek Jones will defend Stanley Liggins. Scott County Judge Marlita Grieve will preside over the case. Both sides face difficulties moving forward because so many years have passed. We'll talk more about the challenges in the next episode. Former prosecutor Bill Davis says,
these cases last until the guy is out of prison or dead.
Next time on Suspect Convictions, we'll talk about what might happen in the third trial.
Look at O.J. Simpson. And if we have a weak judge, and I don't know that we do, I don't know this judge, and let some of that in that's not relevant, that should not be part of the case, we could have a problem. It's concerning.
That's next time on Suspect Convictions. Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. Thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. You can go to suspectconvictions.com for more information. Thanks to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD TV, Channel 8.